Thank you very much. Our next pair are coming, a renegade from this place and his good colleague, and I will, they need no more introduction, so I'll ask Dean Wenthe, please, you introduce the next speaker.
Our next speaker needs no introduction for those who are Fort Wayne students or faculty. He's achieved a sterling record at this institution, and over the years particularly developed his interest in hermeneutics. His departure, I might say, to our sister seminary has spawned all sorts of diverse hermeneutical theories and interpretations. Some have used the language of going up to Jerusalem. Others have thought more in terms of moving nearer to the Vatican. Those within the hermeneutical circle know that he went as a Joshua or a Caleb to spy out the land. Now, leaving these more interesting questions for a moment, we have to rehearse, particularly for any guests or visitors, his career and credentials. He's a 1971 graduate of our St. Louis Seminary. He went immediately to graduate work at Cambridge University in Westfield House, and 5 years later was awarded a PhD in the New Testament department, a very appropriate background to his present paper. He was called to our seminary when it was located in the cultural center of Illinois, Springfield, in 1974, and served until last spring when he was snatched from us. He's a member of the Society of New Testament Studies. He's authored Fundamental Greek Grammar, and along with Gene Benkowski, will be bringing out another book entitled Meaning-Based Hermeneutics, Why I Left Fort Wayne for St. Louis. And the final little accolade that I'd like to pay him, because I just saw it, is that he's going to be the convener of the Reader Response Criticism Task Force of the Society of Biblical Literature. So without further elaboration, he's done many periodical articles and contributed to diverse publications. It's my pleasure and honor to present Dr. James Vells.
Thanks very much. It's great to be back. There should be a two-page outline handout circulating. If you haven't gotten one, please try to get one. I'm surprised Dean didn't mention the World Wrestling Federation, but we'll let that go for another time. The linguistic milieu of the early church. The New Testament is written in Greek. That virtually everyone knows. But what can we say about this language? What was it like? How many spoke it? Where was it spoken? And so on. Indeed, the whole matter is a complicated one. The earliest Christians were Jews, yet their canonical religious writings are not in Hebrew or Aramaic. The earliest Christians were from Palestine, yet the authoritative documents of their new covenant were not in a language native to their land. How do we understand the language of the New Testament against the background of the early church? We will attempt to provide some answers in the paragraphs which follow. The language of the New Testament, socially considered. The Mediterranean milieu. The New Testament, as I have said, is written in Greek. While that fact may surprise the casual observer, in reality, it is not so odd. The key is Alexander the Great. In the 4th century BC, he conquered the Persian Empire, and the aftermath of this conquest unleashed upon the Mediterranean world an influence of things Hellenic, that is, of things Greek, which it is hard to overestimate. Indeed, it is not too much to say that in an incredibly short period of time, not centuries, but decades, A new civilization spanning nations and even continents was created. A new civilization which was simultaneously promoted and enforced by the conquerors on the one hand and eagerly embraced by the conquered on the other. Now Greek law codes were enforced. Greek cities were established, and Greek education was made available. Inhabitants throughout the land of Greece flocked to new lands, ready to take advantage of new opportunities and eager to travel and to explore places until then unknown. While on their own part, the conquered nations adopted and, as I said, eagerly, Greek styles and habits of life, including Greek dress, Greek names, and Greek architecture, as vibrant and full of life. And one element of this new civilization was the language Greek. One element, we should say the chief element. For not only did Alexander and the rulers use Greek as the official language of diplomacy, but the subjected, anxious to fit in and to acclimatize themselves to their new situation, both for survival purposes and because they were attracted to things Greek, adopted Greek as an important means of communication. In the words of the great ancient historian Moses Hadass, "In the beginning, natives may have learned Greek out of necessity, for the uses of commerce or government, or by the compulsion of snobbery, but they continued to use it out of choice, and it soon became at least a second vernacular among a considerable proportion of the population. Upper class natives spoke to each other in Greek and were literate only in Greek. Even books written by natives as propaganda for native values and intended mainly for a native audience were written in Greek. And even books written in native languages were affected in form and content by Greek models." So far, Hadass. Perhaps the greatest testimony to the power of Hellenism in the ancient world in general, and of the Greek language in particular, is the Septuagint, the translation of the Old Testament, the very word of Yahweh, into Greek. B, the Palestinian milieu. And the situation was no different in Palestine. There, too, Greek culture, including the Greek language, was promoted and absorbed. To be sure, all was not received with open arms. Enforced Hellenization by the Seleucid successors to Alexander in Syria, especially the efforts of Antiochus IV, Antiochus Epiphanes, engendered stiff resistance, most notably the Maccabean Revolt, the revolt really of the Hasidim, the Holy Ones, the cultural and religious conservatives of the time in the 2nd century BC. But the march of things Greek continued nonetheless, especially as far as language was concerned. Greek was alive and well in Palestine in the first century of the Christian era and for many years before, for Greek had supplanted Aramaic as the lingua franca of the Eastern Mediterranean, the Levant, which meant that Greek was the language of trade and commerce, also for Palestine, which was within that geographical sphere, even as Aramaic had been for so many centuries before. Indeed, it was more than the language of commerce and trade. Research, especially by Lieberman, Fitzmyer, Lapide, Gundry, and Svenster, has shown that Greek was in common use throughout Palestine in our Lord's time. Not only is this confirmed by rabbinic sources, but archaeology has brought to light wide use of Greek for inscriptions on monuments, on pottery, and on tombstones, as well as in letters and in official documents. And if C.F.D. Mole is correct in his exegesis of Acts 6, verse 1, the Hellenistai of this important verse were Jews in Jerusalem and the surrounding countryside who habitually spoke Greek, to the virtual exclusion of Hebrew or Aramaic. And this spread and use of Greek made the language situation in Palestine much more complex than is normally supposed. The common approach, common since the 1890s, is to assume quite simply that Aramaic was the dominant language of the land and that Jesus spoke in Aramaic when he taught. Julius Wellhausen, for example, said Jesus himself spoke Aramaic, and his words, like the stories about him, ran about in the Jerusalem community, which had Aramaic also as their tongue. Das steht historisch fest. That is an historical certainty. My own sainted teacher, Martin Charlemagne, often said in class, the New Testament is in Greek, Jesus spoke Aramaic. But not only was Greek a living language for the early believers in our Lord, Aramaic was also a living language, of course, having been so in Palestine for some 600 years, but Hebrew was a living language as well. Research, again, has shown that Hebrew was a flourishing language in Palestine in the first century AD. From the evidence presented by Birkeland, Grintz, Siegel, Lapide, Fitzmyer, Millick, and Emerton, we can see that Hebrew was both written and spoken extensively in the time of Christ. In the words of J.T. Millick, the copper scrolls and documents from the Second Revolt prove beyond reasonable doubt that Mishnaic Hebrew was the normal language of the Judean population in the Roman period. Some Jewish scholars had already suggested this on the basis of Talmudic anecdotes. Additional evidence can be found in the inscriptions on contemporary ossuaries. The presence of Hebrew beside Greek and Aramaic on the ossuaries, which represent the use of the middle classes, surely attests that this was a natural language in that milieu. So, it is probable that many, if not most, of the inhabitants of the land of Israel were trilingual, or better, to follow the analysis of Pinchas Lapide in his outstanding study, Insights from Qumran into the Language of Jesus, it is probable that the inhabitants of the land of Israel were triglossic. That is, that they spoke three languages, not interchangeably, but for discrete purposes, using Greek for political purposes and for converse either with Gentiles or with Jews of the diaspora, Hebrew for religion, education, and other aspects of high culture, and Aramaic for hearth, home, and livelihood. These thoughts are interesting and important in themselves, but they are of special importance when one proceeds to a linguistic analysis of the language of the New Testament as we have it, for the complicated social juxtaposition and interrelationship of the three languages as we have described it, in this case, Aramaic, Hebrew, and Greek, complicates an analysis of a single language, in this case, Greek, since many cross-cultural influences occur. Indeed, the history of the discussion of the language of the New Testament is bedeviled by the problem of the influence, or lack thereof, of the two Semitic languages, Hebrew and Aramaic, on the focus language, Greek. Yet such an analysis must be done, and to this analysis we now turn. Part 3, the language of the New Testament linguistically considered. A, given our historical social survey, what is the language of the New Testament like? That is to say, what can we say about it linguistically? The answer to this inquiry is in some ways simple. It has Hellenic, that is, Greek characteristics, and it has Semitic, in this case, Hebrew, Aramaic, or both characteristics, and it has but these things are not really as simple as they might seem. Two problems exist. First, What are these characteristics exactly, these Hellenic and Semitic characteristics? Second, how do they relate to one another? It may be noted that these are problems which have haunted scholarship at least since the time of the Reformation, and even in a tangentially related way before, and no easy answer exists. Scholars differ, and this difference is often extreme, and it is proper for me to admit that at the outset of this section before my own views are made known. But I will hazard an analysis of my own today, giving my own personal viewpoint, recognizing that new evidence and new formulations may be just around the corner. Point B, Hellenic or Greek characteristics. The language of the New Testament is Greek, but what sort of Greek is it? It is perhaps a truism, but it is worth saying nonetheless that it is not Attic Greek, what is usually called Classical Greek, the Greek of 5th century B.C., Athens, the Greek of Aeschylus, Sophocles, Euripides, Lysias, and Thucydides. Rather, the Greek of the New Testament is Koine Greek, the Greek of Hellenistic times. That is to say, it is the Greek of the time coinciding with and following after the rise of Philip of Macedon, and especially his son Alexander the Great, the Greek of the late 4th century B.C. and beyond, the Greek spread by the great conqueror and his soldiers drawn from every quarter of the Greek-speaking world. For this insight, we are indebted principally to Adolf Deissmann. How may this Greek be described? In some ways, its nature is quite surprising. One might expect, given the historical circumstances, that it would be a ragged thing, a motley collection of various dialects, such as Ionian or Aeolic, with no unifying characteristics at all. But such is not the case. One surprisingly unified language was in widespread use, called by the Greeks themselves the Koine Dialectos, the common dialect, and it is generally seen as a development of Attic, the Athenian sub-dialect of Ionian, flavored in large measure by broader Ionian influence. Ionia was the area of Asia Minor, of Turkey, on the western side, the southwestern side. The spoken version of the Koine, a development not of the language of the great literature of 5th century Athens B.C., but of the spoken Greek of that city, which itself had absorbed many foreign words and constructions found later in the Koine, exhibited the following characteristics when compared to classical Greek. So these now would be the characteristics of spoken Koine Greek. And on your handout, you have some examples, which I will come to in just a moment. I'm giving you the general characteristics, and I will come to the examples then as specific examples of them after this. Here are the general characteristics of spoken Koine. One, a multiplicity of new words with new meanings attached to many old words. Two, a tendency toward explicit expression, lexically. That is, as far as vocabulary is concerned, this meant the preference for fuller and phonetically stronger forms. Syntactically, it is seen chiefly in the increased frequency of prepositions and pronouns, and in the preference for direct as opposed to indirect discourse. Three, a strong tendency toward simplicity. This manifested itself in two ways. On the one hand, a firm movement toward uniformity is evident. Morphologically, this meant elimination or modification of unusual forms of all parts of speech and the assimilation of potentially ambiguous forms to those which are more easily recognizable. On the other hand, the loss of fine distinctions is also apparent. Lexically, this is seen in the free use of compound and diminutive vocables with no specifically compounded or diminutive meaning. And syntactically, and this is really the most important factor, it is seen in the decline of the optative mood, the decline in the use of the present tense in moods other than the indicative, the decline in the number and rich combination of particles, the increasing restriction of the middle voice to deponent usage, the expansion of the use of hina, and the frequency of parataxis, that is, linked coordinate clauses, in the place of hypotaxis, subordinate clauses dependent upon one another. Now, examples from the New Testament would include the following, and here you have them listed. First, regarding vocabulary changes. Gregoreo, meaning to watch, in Mark 13:35, and chromphia, meaning sword, in Revelation 1:16, which are new Koine Greek words. B, phano, meaning to arrive, instead of to anticipate, in 1 Thessalonians 2:16, and enkupto, meaning to hinder, instead of to cut, in Galatians 5:7, which are old words, classical words, with new Koine Greek meanings attached. Second, with regard to the move toward explicit expression. A, probaton, meaning sheep, in place of ois, the classical Greek word, in John 21:16, and akalutheo, meaning to follow, in place of hepomai, in Matthew 8:1, both of which are phonetically stronger forms. B, prosauton, indicating indirect object to him, in place of the dative form auto, and that's he said to him, in John 3:4, which illustrates the increased use of prepositional phrase constructions. Third, as examples of the striving for simplicity, A, dikneo, meaning to show, in place of dikneme, the classical Greek form, in John 2:18, which changes an unusual form, a me verb form, assimilating it to what is more recognizable, a normal verbal pattern. B, an angelo, instead of angelo, meaning to announce, in John 4:25, and paideon, instead of pais, meaning child, in Matthew 14:21, which illustrates the use of compounds and diminutives with the loss of specifically compound or diminutive meaning. And C, finally, the use of a hina clause instead of an infinitive in 1 John 1:9 and 1 Corinthians 1:10. And the and by the way, I might say, not for purpose. The use of the hina clause was restricted to purpose in classical Greek. And the use of kai and de to link coordinate clauses, parataxis, instead of participles subordinating one clause to another, hypotaxis, as in Mark's account of the crucifixion of our Lord in 15, verses 23 to 26. You might want to look at that later, and you see the paratactic sentence structure there. And all of these illustrate the streamlining and the simplifying of syntactical structure. We may say, then, that the Gospel of Mark and the Gospel and Epistles of St. John are composed in vernacular Koine Greek, as well as major portions of most other New Testament books. As far as the written Koine is concerned, it too was a development of the Greek dialect of Athens, but while it was always heavily indebted to classical Attic, it often deviated markedly from it, in vocabulary especially, being influenced by the vernacular. Indeed, later Koine authors, notably Polybius and Josephus, made considerable concessions to the vernacular, though their writings taken together show a great variety of usage. Hence, it may be said, following Albert Thumb, a German authority on modern Greek, that the different forms of Hellenistic Literatursprache, the literary speech, are finally nothing other than a proceeding compromise between the spoken language and the older written traditions, as he says, zwischen Leben und Schule, a compromise between life and what is taught in the school. And the degree of this compromise depended upon the education and so on of each author. Now, examples from the New Testament of literary koine would be, on your sheet again after that little break, kritone, which is a classical Greek form, meaning better, the comparative of agathos, in place of chrysone with double sigma, which is koine Greek in Hebrews 1:4. Hypotactic sentence structure with complex subordination of phrases and clauses in place of the simpler parataxis in Hebrews 6, verses 4 to 6, and the use of the optative mood to replace an indicative in indirect discourse in a secondary sequence, that is, after a past tense main verb, which is very classical. Instead of retaining the indicative, in Luke 1:29, and this is, by the way, is the statement of Mary, or Luke's report, she was wondering what sort of greeting this IA, optative of the verb to be, usually translated might be, but it's probably best. She was wondering what the heck kind of a greeting this was. It gives that idea of the wonderment behind that. It's a wonderful touch by Luke. In the New Testament, the books of Hebrews, 1 Peter, James, and at times those of St. Luke and St. Paul may be said to employ literary Koine Greek to a greater or lesser extent. Thus, the Greek of the New Testament exhibits the full range of linguistic possibilities available to the writers of the first century AD. And if you turn your page to the next side. Indeed, if we consider a diagram devised by W.L. Wunderlich to portray the full range of speech in a society at large, and you can see that bar diagram, seeing that some linguistic usages are inaccessible to the educated at the top of the diagram, even as others are not acceptable to the educated, the bottom of the diagram, while the large middle portion is acceptable to all and accessible to all, we may say that by far the vast majority of New Testament writers employ language in such a way that it falls into the large common overlap area, most notably St. Matthew and St. Paul, which is appropriate for writers who wish to proclaim the message of salvation to all sorts and conditions of men. C, Semitic characteristics. As we noted at the beginning of this major section, the Greek of the New Testament, in addition to its Hellenic characteristics, possesses Semitic characteristics almost inevitably, given the social and historical matrix of the early church. And I might say, for Mark Sell's benefit, who was wondering if I could give an entire paper without using the word matrix, I couldn't. But what characteristics are these which we may note? Again, as we have said, little agreement exists on these matters, but it is reasonable to assume Semitic interference in New Testament Koine Greek in two substantial ways. One, lexically, both by the presence of foreign words and especially by the usage of non-Greek meanings with Greek words. And secondly, syntactically, by constructions which are not congenial to basic forms of Greek. The following examples are examples of both kinds. And now again, I have them on your sheet. First, lexical interference from Semitic. Pascha, meaning Passover in 1 Corinthians 5:7, and Rabbi, meaning Rabbi in 1 John 3:38, which represent the importation of foreign words directly into Greek. More importantly, B, doxa means glory in Romans 15:27, instead of opinion in normal secular Greek, and eidolon means idol in 1 Corinthians 8:4 instead of phantom as in normal Koine Greek, both of which represent the filling of Greek words with not Greek, but Hebrew or Aramaic meaning. Two, second, syntactical interference. Luke 20, verse 11, contains the words which you see written here, prosethetā heteron pempsai doulon, meaning, and again he sent another slave, which corresponds to the Hebrew construction with hosif. The again part is with the finite verb, oddly enough, prosethetā. Mark 8:12 contains the words, it looks like half a sentence here, I dothesetai te genea, if it is given to this generation, this sign, the same ion, meaning surely a sign will not be given to this generation, which corresponds to the Hebrew construction with im. And John 16:17 contains the words, I pan un ek ton mate ton autu pros allelus, meaning then some of his disciples said to one another, taking that ek ton mate ton phrase there, which corresponds to the Hebrew usage of min. All of these constructions are more Semitic than they are true Greek. It is important to note, however, that the problem is much more subtle than is generally supposed, especially with regard to syntactical matters. For it is necessary to distinguish between what James Hope Moulton called primary Semitisms on the one hand and secondary Semitisms on the other. A primary Semitism is a construction which is bad Greek, unnatural Greek, something a native Greek speaker would never say. It is what we have described so far, those examples I've given you on the sheet. A secondary Semitism is a construction which is not bad Greek per se, but it is one which corresponds to a construction in Hebrew or Aramaic, and whose usage, therefore, makes one suspect that Semitic influence is at work. Here, frequency is key. A frequent usage of such a construction is often unnatural and uncommon with native speakers of Greek, but common and all too frequent with those acquainted with or working with a Semitic tongue. Examples of these would be, and again these are on your sheet now, ento plus the infinitive in a temporal sense. You can find that in some secular Greek. But this corresponds to the Hebrew b, as in Luke 5:1, and it came to pass while the crowds were sitting by him. So that use in that temporal sense is possible in Koine Greek, but very common, duplicating something in the Hebrew. Here's another one. The order of attributive adjectives and nouns corresponding to the normal Hebrew pattern, namely article noun, article adjective, as in Matthew 6:11. Ton arton, ton epiousion. Give us our bread, our daily bread, rather than ton epiousion arton. The repeat pattern rather than the sandwich pattern. And three, adjectival genitives corresponding to the Hebrew and Aramaic tendency to use a noun in the genitive in place of an adjective to modify another noun, as in 2 Thessalonians 2:3, the man of lawlessness, the son of perdition, rather than the lawless man. And four, N used instrumentally, corresponding to the Hebrew b, again, as in Revelation 2:16, I will fight with them in a sword of my mouth, by means of a sword of my mouth, with polemeso. In each of these cases, Greek examples may be found, but not in anything like the frequency which the New Testament enjoys. How extensive, then, is Semitic interference in New Testament Greek as we have examined it? That is not at all apparent. The issue, it should be quite clear, revolves around the matter of secondary Semitisms, which constructions may be so classified, and this is really an argument regarding frequency. That is, how frequent is frequent for the sake of linguistic comparison? And the evidence changes day by day. Stanley Watson, in a recent publication, November 1989, has argued quite convincingly that several constructions thought to be rare in Greek and frequent in Hebrew and Aramaic, and therefore by frequent usage, secondary Semitisms, and examples would be the use of the future indicative in place of a tense of the subjunctive after hinna, or imperatival use of the participle, that these are in fact frequent in Koine Greek of Hellenistic times, and therefore they cannot be classified as Semitisms in any real sense at all. Finally, it is right to ask what the cause of the Semitisms which do exist is, for it is a question which has importance for our understanding of the life of the early church. Again, there is little consensus on this matter, but the following may be noted. Some Semitisms seem to be directly attributable to external factors, to factors outside the mental world of the individual author himself. Aside from the obvious, a transliteration, the taking over directly what a principal speaks in Hebrew or Aramaic, such as Eli, Eli, lema sabachthani in Matthew 27:46, some Semitic interference may represent translations from other texts. On the one hand, we may think of written texts. Quotations from the Septuagint are obvious examples of such Semitic interference, for the Septuagint itself is a translation of a Hebrew text. But this point does raise the question of written Semitic texts. Forlagen, whether in the form of logia collections or some other format, for certain portions of New Testament texts, such as the sayings of our Lord, which contain Semitisms at every turn. On the other hand, unwritten texts may be translational sources for the same portions of the New Testament. Semitic oral traditions, which have now been rendered into Greek, such as those hypothesized for almost 80 years by form critical studies. Other Semitisms are attributable to internal factors, to factors within the mental world of the individual author himself. And here two items may be noted. The first is the Septuagint, the Old Testament translation into Greek. By this I do not mean quotations of the Septuagint, but rather the linguistic influence of the Septuagint on early Christian speech patterns. The Septuagint was surely widely known, which means that the words and the structures of this book, work, itself heavily Semitic as translation Greek, impress themselves upon the thought of early Christian writers in the same way in which the King James Version has affected the speech of English-speaking Christians throughout the world. Indeed, Septuagintisms, both real and imitational, have been detected by Max Wilcox and several others. An example he gives is Luke 1:78, and I think you have that on your sheet, Anatole ex hypsus, day spring from on high, which imitates Septuagint talk, but isn't actually a quote of the Septuagint anywhere. It is hard, I believe, to overestimate the influence of the Septuagint on the New Testament writers as a whole. The second internal source of interference is Semitic linguistic competence on the part of those whose native language was the Hebrew or Aramaic tongue. A man grows up speaking and thinking Hebrew or Aramaic. Later, he also acquires Greek. But his Semitic patterns of expression, his Semitic turns of phrase, never leave him altogether, though he becomes fluent in his second tongue. Even as those born in Germany or France never speak English totally as a native, with total idiomatic command, exhibiting especially native language interference of the secondary kind. Such interference need not be harsh or frequent, but it is present nonetheless, being more or less in evidence in each individual case. There is not, in my opinion, however, clear and strong evidence for a special Jewish Greek dialect spoken by Semitic people, a Jewish Greek patois, which type of special dialect has been conjectured by many since Edwin Hatch in the 19th century, most strongly in our century by Nigel Turner, and most recently by Stephen Thompson in his new study on the Book of Revelation. Indeed, sociolinguistic study itself would suggest that this is not the case, for Greek was the prestige language of the Mediterranean world, and in such a multilingual setting, linguistic transfer normally occurs in the direction from, not toward, the dominant language of the time. And now finally, point D, very briefly. The relationship between Hellenic and Semitic features in New Testament Greek and their significance. Let us conclude our study by asking, what is the relationship between the two sets of characteristics of New T Greek as we have noted them, the Hellenic and Semitic? Each student must decide for himself on the matter, but the way I read the evidence, the Hellenic factors are dominant in the end. Yes, Semitic constructions do appear. Yes, Semitic vocabulary does abound. But the Greek of the New Testament is still Greek. It is true Hellenistic Greek. It is not basically Hebrew disguised as Greek or Aramaic in Greek dress or garb. It is truly Greek, Koine Greek, with a Semitic tinge, a tinge which may be traced in large measure to the Septuagint, as I have said. And this should not surprise us in the least. For our God is incarnational, beyond a shadow of a doubt. He is a God who works with tools. Tools he has at hand, but tools appropriate to the task. And the language of the New Testament, as we have it in our books, is appropriate to this task. For it is truly Greek, the lingua franca of its time, able to reach many peoples and nations throughout the ancient world with no language barrier at all. Yet, salvation is of the Jews. The Old Testament still is true. And the incarnational roots, the heritage from the Semitic past, is still present, not only in the thought, the doctrine, and the truths, but also in something of the very form by which that truth is told. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Veltz. I believe we have a few minutes for any questions that any of the participants might think.
Dr. Veltz, very interesting paper. Thank you very much. Looking at that diagram that you have there, I would just venture that the Greek of the letter to the Hebrews would be among the more erudite vocabulary.
That's right.
And on the basis of that, would you care to speculate as to the human writer of the letter to the Hebrews in view of some of the characteristics that you have brought out?
That's very interesting. First, let me say you're absolutely correct. I think it would be right to put the book of Hebrews above that wavy line, and you'll notice that the line is wavy toward the top, whereas the bottom one, separating the middle part from the bottom third, is a straight line for this reason. It's a straight line at the bottom because there are generally acceptable standards of what you would call correct usage. But at the top, what would constitute things inaccessible to those who are untrained, well, that's a little bit more in flux, and so the line is wavy up there. The best study that's been done in this was from one of my teachers and also one of Dean's teachers, Dr. Walter Jenrick, who taught for many years at Concordia, Milwaukee, Concordia Mequon. And indeed, he wrote his doctoral dissertation at Washington University in 1947 and did two articles for the CTM, the old Concordia Theological Monthly, in 48, I believe, comparing the diction of the book of Hebrews with the book of Romans as being kind of quintessential Paul, and concluded that from all different points of view, that in fact the book of Hebrews was not written by St. Paul. So I think he's probably right on this. There are many factors here, one of which, and I quoted examples from Hebrews, I didn't have time to deal with it in this paper, one of which was a very important development in Koine times called the atticistic reaction, which was around the 2nd century BC, people started to say, hey, our language doesn't sound like the language of Sophocles